jurisdiction within 21 days. And once those briefs have been received, the case will be taken under advisement. We'll go now to the third case of the morning, Quapo against Chippewa County. Mr. Porter.
Your Honor, I'm Steve Porter from Madison, Wisconsin. My client, Blaine Quapo, appears in person. I just want the court to know that Mr. Quapo finished work last night at 8 or 9 o'clock and drove for 8 hours to be here this morning. This case is important to him. This case started out as a bigger, more complex case, and it included issues alleging First Amendment retaliation in employment and another due process claim of the Constantinople variety that had to do with the publishing information about Mr. Quapo in a picture that was defamatory. And we have not challenged the district court's decision on those claims, but we challenged the decision on whether or not Mr. Quapo was entitled to due process before he was suspended and before he was fired from his job as a seasonal
employee. I understood he just was not called back, that there was no contract.
He was fired, Your Honor.
Well, he did.
I mean, his
did he have
I'm sorry.
Was he fully employed year in, year out, or was he a part-time employee?
It was seasonal. He was
seasonal.
He was called back on a seasonal when they needed him. He would be called back in the spring. No, he would serve on a regular basis.
He had a contract of employment that said you'll serve from this time to this time?
No, but he was to have continuous employment during the season that they needed his work.
When they had the need of him.
Right.
Am I correct?
Only in certain parts of the year.
Okay. Go ahead.
And he had been employed as a seasonal employee. This was his third year that he'd been called back, and all of his performance evaluations had been good. It's our notion that this termination arose out of a long-standing 8-year dispute that Mr. Quapo had with the Building and Zoning Department.
Was it a termination or a failure to call him back to work?
He was fired. He was brought in and given a termination letter, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. And that was in June. He would have otherwise been expected to continue in well into the fall with his employment. He operated his own business on the side, snow plowing, lawn mowing, real estate cleanouts. He had some property in another township where he stored equipment and whatnot, and he had a long-running dispute with the zoning inspector and building inspector regarding that. That came to a head in the summer of 2008, we think significantly after the zoning inspector discovered that he was a seasonal employee with the county. And Mr. Quapo, he commenced enforcement, went onto Mr. Quapo's property with a warrant, and cited Mr. Quapo for a couple of infractions of the zoning building code ordinance regarding junk cars and operating a salvage function.
Mr. Porter, you are disputing, are you, that he signed the receipt for the employee handbook that said his employment was at will?
We are not disputing that. He did sign that. It's our notion that an employee handbook, especially one that disclaims creating any contractual rights or binding obligations, has any bearing on this case. And it certainly does not.
It has no bearing?
Pardon?
How can it have no bearing if he acknowledged before the employment that it was an at-will job?
I don't think that's a legally binding acknowledgement. I think it solely has to do with the provisions contained in that you know, the handbook. It just says this handbook doesn't create a contract. It doesn't say I'm giving up my rights under the civil personnel ordinance for the county. So when, you know, Mr. Quaffle started to complain, he was complain about the enforcement. He was suspended, and then shortly thereafter that he was terminated purportedly because his employer claimed that he had run a member of the public off the road while driving a county truck. Mr. Quaffle adamantly denies that, and however, he was not given an opportunity to have a hearing on that before he was terminated. And by a hearing, we're saying he wasn't even asked, you know, did you do this? Or can you explain yourself as to why we shouldn't believe you did this? He was fired. He lost his voice. And what due process in employment is about is employee voice. And we all know that there's been a trend in the law and the legislation these days to remove employee voice. And it's significant and important, I think, that this court takes seriously the question of whether Mr. Quaffle did have a property interest that entitled him to due process, even of a minimal variety in employment, prior to being terminated. The significant thing here is that the only cases really in this circuit that deal with this language, the specific language in the ordinance in this case, which is that an employee may be disciplined for just cause. Those are the operative words that we're trying to construe. There's only one other case that I'm aware of and that's been cited in the briefs that really pertain to that as coming before this court, or and it hasn't come really in any definitive way before the Wisconsin courts, is the Lashbrook case, which has virtually the same language and rubric for the disciplinary system. But the difference between this case and Lashbrook is, number one, Lashbrook's an Illinois case, and as we all know, property interests are created under state law, and therefore we must look to Wisconsin law for whether a property interest has been created by the ordinance, pertinent ordinance in this case. But second of all, the question of just cause was really not construed in the Lashbrook case or what kind of language it would take to establish just cause for termination. There's kind of a throwaway sentence that says, well, that sounds permissive, but the real decision that was made in that case, it was not decided on the basis of the sufficiency of the language that is similar to the language in this case. It was decided on the basis of the fact that for an employee handbook to create a contract, there has to be a higher standard. There has to be a higher level of mandatory language because handbooks are so often disclaimed or not very clearly indicated to be contracts. It's the difference between construing a handbook as a contract versus construing a statute in which the presumption is that the legislature, the county board, would not have put the language of just cause in there unless it meant it was supposed to mean something. Now, the district court concluded that, well, the word may makes it permissive, but it's the same thing sort of as saying, well, we're all going to go to the ball game tomorrow. Programs may be purchased for $5. Is there any doubt that the price for the program is $5 in that kind of a case? And should there be any question, really, that you may discipline for just cause means that you may discipline without just cause? It simply means you can decide. It's your decision as the employer to decide whether to discipline, but if you do it, you should have just cause. Otherwise, the words just cause are purely superfluous, and we are not supposed to construe statutes in that way. So, you know, I cited a number of cases in my brief and before the district court that in which similar language did appear in Wisconsin's decisions, and I think it's fair to accept our arguments that the use of the issue never came up before the court, and that may well be because it's just seemed like such an obvious thing to employers in Wisconsin and employees in Wisconsin. I don't know, but the point is that the context of the may discipline for just cause language, as it shows up in various circumstances, as I quoted in my brief, it's clear that that is with the understanding that basically it creates a just cause standard to be applied in employment. And, you know, we have these other cases from Illinois as well, the Fitcher case, which actually is a Wisconsin case, but various other Wisconsin or Illinois cases that are construed here really aren't on point because they deal with language that is not really a term of art like just cause. I mean, the term just cause is a technical term, really, that is well understood.
Counsel, I'm lost about this emphasis on just cause. The ordinance refers to just cause, and then it says maybe disciplined, just cause including but not limited to the following infractions of work rules. Including but not limited to. There are then a whole bunch of examples. The ordinance says individual jurisdictions may have additional rules to the above list. In other words, it's not the magic phrase in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence is there has to be a legitimate claim of entitlement to create a property interest. It's awfully hard to see how this ordinance creates a legitimate claim of entitlement when it's got the language not limited to, and then it says individual departments may add to the list, which is to say they may do what they want. Where's the claim of entitlement here?
The claim of entitlement is that the employee may be disciplined if there is a determination of a violation of the disciplinary rules that are listed there as exemplary versus others of a similar nature. It doesn't even say
of a similar nature. It says units may add to the list. Don't say they have to be of a similar nature.
Well, I think the proper way to construe those is that if you list things of that nature which are a misconduct type of character, that those are that the rest of the list or the other things that might come under the umbrella are also of the same type of item. I think though that the listing is not the important part. I think the important part is the just cause, which, you know, has been understood for decades in employee and civil service law and in labor law to specifically guarantee employees the chance, basically, I think, to be heard.
It doesn't specifically do anything. The ordinance says just cause including but not limited to, and then effectively says each employing unit can do what it wants. Where's the legitimate claim of entitlement?
I think there's an element of just cause that has to do with some reason to have a conclusion, a reasonable judgment that the person actually committed an infraction of the rules. Because it's not just cause to discipline somebody for something that they didn't do.
It seems to me you're confusing substance and procedure. Maybe what you're arguing is that an ordinance like this entitles every employee to a hearing to go into whether there's a violation of the rules. But the Constitution does not require states to follow their own law about hearings. Right. The only question here is whether there's a substantive, legitimate claim of entitlement. And then federal law will provide whether there is a hearing. And indeed, the Supreme Court held exactly that in a case called Olam against Wakinakona, which I notice your brief doesn't mention.
That's correct. It does not mention that. But I think the notions of just cause, Your Honor, if I may, are such that the term just has significance. And to discipline somebody for something they didn't do that's of a misconduct type nature is not just, and it's typically not accepted as just under the historical use of that term. And there are other cases that have been cited, I think, including the Fitcher case, that do say that there's no dispute. And I think the district court even accepted the fact that a just cause standard does create a property interest under Wisconsin law. I believe that was.
But not when it's permissive.
See, I guess that's our argument is that you can't have just cause that's permissive. Otherwise, it becomes a super. Why even say it? Why not just say you can discipline for any reason you feel like, which is what the handbook said. And
then why say may? rather than shall.
Because the May says you don't have, if you have just cause, you don't have to discipline. You get to use your employer discretion as to whether to proceed with discipline or not, and at what level. That's where the employer has the discretion. Where the employer is limited is to the extent that the employer cannot discipline without just cause. And I mean, I think that's the crux. And I guess at this point, I would just reserve the rest of my argument.
Thank you, Mr. Porter.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Doyle.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Attorney Amy Doyle, and I represent the defendants in this case, Chippewa County, Sheriff Kowalczyk, William Reynolds, Bruce Delsner, and Doug Cleary. Mr. Quapla was correct that there is only one issue on appeal in this case, and that's whether Mr. Quapla's due process rights were violated when he was terminated from his employment by Chippewa County. This case is no longer about a zoning issue. It's specifically whether he had a property interest in his employment as a seasonal employee with Chippewa County.
Your position is he's an at-will employee.
That's correct. That he was an at-will employee. He did not have any employment contract with Chippewa County.
So that each season where they wanted him back, they would call him back.
Right, and that would
be
dependent on...
He didn't show up, right? Just
correct.
Show up. He had to be called back.
He would be called back dependent on, you know, what type of work was available, how many employees they needed, of course, their expertise. And there was no guarantee, there's no specific time period, even when he was called back, on how long he would work. It really would be dependent on the type of work that needed to be done. It's our position that the district court got it right in this case in dismissing the case on summary judgment, and therefore we're asking this court to affirm that dismissal. To establish a due process violation, Quapel had to establish three factors. Number one, that he had a property interest in his employment, that the county deprived him of that interest, and that he did not receive a due process hearing. Now, the county does not dispute that it terminated his employment, but again, it disputes that he had a property interest in his employment. Whether there exists a property interest in one's employment is really a issue of state law. And as Quapel's attorney indicated, there really are not a lot of Wisconsin cases that has interpreted this type of phrase or ordinance.
And isn't the presumption in Wisconsin that an employee is at will?
That is correct. There is a presumption that an employee is at will, and unless there is another type of state statute or ordinance or contract or some other document that establishes, you know, some expectation or right of that employment. And it's our position that whether you look at the employee handbook, which explicitly indicated that this was an at-will agreement, and that is a document that Mr. Quapel signed every year when he returned for his employment. Mr. Quapel even admitted at his deposition that it was his understanding that he was an at-will employee, and he had no right to return to the county the following year for, you know, additional seasonal employment. There was no contract. He was not part of the union contract, with the exception of some provisions relating to payment. So the only issue left is whether the county ordinance 4862 provided Mr. Quapel with a property interest in his employment. And we disagree with Quapel's interpretation of that ordinance. Quapel argues that the ordinance gives him an expectation of continued employment because it uses the two words just cause. And according to the plaintiff, this requires, you know, some hearing before he is terminated. It's our position that this is not how the ordinance reads, that it essentially ignores other portions of the ordinance and other phrases, and when you read the ordinance as a whole, it really is written in permissive terms as opposed to mandatory terms. And the cases that we have cited in our brief, you know, go into the issue of permissive language versus mandatory language, the use of the word shall, or that employee only can be terminated for a cause, as opposed to the use of the word may. And even beyond the word may be disciplined for just cause, as the ordinance states, as your honors have indicated, you know, it goes on to indicate the reasons that an employee can be terminated, and it's limited to certain rules, but it also indicates that other individual departments may have additional rules that are not even, you know, provided for in this ordinance. And even looking at the specific examples under the ordinance, some of them are so overbroad and vague that essentially allows an employee to be terminated for almost any reason whatsoever. For example, in the ordinance, I think it's under paren 8, but it provides that. Paren 8, it talks about creating a disturbance on the work premises by fighting or other conduct which adversely affects morale, production, or maintenance of proper discipline. You know, so there are examples just in the ordinance itself that really does not limit any type of the discretion of the county. And some of the cases that we cited in our brief explain the importance of some type of limiting the discretion of the county, you know, as an indication that some property interest is created by the language in the ordinance, or whether you're talking about an employee handbook or whatever contract you're talking about. And, for example, some of the cases that we cited, and one case is a Wisconsin case, it's Cole versus MATC. It doesn't use the exact language that we're talking about, but it is a Wisconsin case. And in that case, it talks about, I think, the difference between the mandatory language versus the permissive language. And it also explains that there is a gray area between an at-will employee and an employee that has a property interest in his employment. It's our position that Mr. Kwapa was an at-will employee. But even if you look and you accept the plaintiff's argument with the words just cause, at most he would fall closer to the gray area, but not even come close to having any property interest in his employment. Another case that we cited, and it is an Illinois case. A lot of the cases we cited were Illinois cases or from Indiana. But it was the Flanagan case versus, I think, Winnebago County, a Seventh Circuit case, 2007. And in that case, it involved language that was similar. And the court talked about language of may be discharged for cause. And the court indicated that the use of the word may, and that was permissive, simply because you can be dismissed for cause doesn't mean that you can only be dismissed for just cause. So the court made that distinction. The same thing is true in the Moss versus Martin case, a Seventh Circuit case, and I think that was Indiana, where the court explained that permissive language in the agreement that an employee may be discharged for cause did not mean that the discharge could only be for cause. And that's our argument here, that even if you look at the words just cause, which that's essentially taking that out of the context of the entire ordinance, it's not enough to establish a property interest. And our final argument is that if you look at this ordinance in conjunction with the following ordinance, 6863, it again supports our position that this was a permissive language. 4862 talk about work rules and then goes on to give some examples of what could justify some discipline, including termination. 4863 talks about the discipline recommended, and that ordinance goes on to state, for consistency in administering discipline countywide, the following discipline is recommended for violation of the above rules, which is Ordinance 4862. So it's our position that both of these statutes together provide guidance to, I guess, supervisors and informs also employees as to the type of discipline and that can be imposed. And also, I think the goal is to strive for uniformity on certain infractions and the type of discipline imposed. But that is not enough to create a property interest under the Constitution. If there are no other questions, we will rest on our briefs and request that the decision be affirmed. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, Ms. Doyle. Anything further, Mr. Porter?
Yes, briefly, Your Honor.
It's certainly going to be brief. Got about 20 seconds, I would estimate.
I'll talk fast. It's our position, Judge, that in response to your questioning, Judge Easterbrook, that the cause has a meaning in Wisconsin law, and that whether it says only for just cause or as it does in this ordinance, you know, we don't believe that that a legislature should have to say we really mean it, or to have some sort of a way of saying, you know, when you've got ordinances that have been around for a while, they need to be construed according to the rules of statutory construction. We shouldn't set a higher hurdle here.
Thank you, Mr. Porter.
Thank you very much, Judge.
The case is taken under advisement.
All right.
We'll hear argument now in the case of Granberry against.